I'm in the town of Bjordanka, just outside Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, and this place was completely decimated by Russian tanks when the war began 2 years ago. And later on the program, we'll be bringing you a special report from Ukraine to find out how the people and their spirits are holding up.
2 years at war. It's Ukraine versus Russia in a land war that has had brutal consequences.
I have a friend who came home and his daughter called him uncle instead of dad because she didn't know who he was.
The toll on soldiers gone from their families for 2 years. Ukraine seeks solutions to get more manpower for the fight against its much bigger foe. Our special report from Ukraine ahead.
I really love the intersection of faith and culture.
Discovering how faith influences beauty at the New York encounter. And taking his love of the Eucharist and adoration to the streets. We follow the path of a runner determined to spread the good news. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
People are tired because now 2 years of this invasion, and we never know where it will be finished.
The war in Ukraine grinds on, a way of life destroyed, homes demolished by artillery attacks, thousands of soldiers and civilians dead, millions of people displaced. This is the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro, sitting in this week for Monte Alvarado. With exhausted troops and dwindling ammunition and supplies, the news from the front has grown increasingly more grim for Ukraine. Last weekend, Ukrainian generals announced they had to withdraw from Avdiivka, an industrial town in the southeast, a loss that could deal a blow to an already weakened morale. These images are from Avdiivka right before the last troops withdrew. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his soldiers are hindered by low ammunition supplies and that this deficit is giving Russian troops breathing space. He said his military commander withdrew troops from Avdiivka to prevent them from being surrounded. But defense analysts worry the withdrawal came late and hundreds of soldiers may have been captured or killed by advancing Russian troops. Along with more weapons, Ukraine needs more troops. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers have been killed or wounded on both sides since the war began 2 years ago. Though the U.S. Defense Department estimates Russian casualties at a staggering 315,000 troops, Russia has a much larger population to draw from. To address the manpower shortage in Ukraine, a new law could be passed in weeks, paving the way for a significant increase in conscription numbers to bolster the thousands of soldiers who have volunteered. EWTN News in Depth got the viewpoint of a young Ukrainian soldier who lost his leg in trench warfare on the front lines.
I think the guys that are out there on the front lines, they've been there for a very long time. They deserve a break and have the right to be replaced. I know a lot of guys who have small children that they've never even met because they've been fighting all this time. So I do think it's necessary to mobilize new people, even ones without experience.
If passed, the new law would lower the age of men required to register for the draft and include tougher penalties for those who fail to obey draft orders. But the measure is controversial because of the delicate balance Ukraine must maintain to keep enough people in the labor force for its economy to still function. While Ukraine struggles against the odds, much-needed U.S. military aid remains in limbo on Capitol Hill. A foreign aid package, which includes $60 billion for Ukraine, was passed in the Senate by a bipartisan vote of 70-29 earlier this month. It also included funding for Israel and Taiwan. Instead of putting the measure on the House floor for a vote, House Speaker Mike Johnson adjourned Congress for a two-week recess. America's United Nations ambassador is speaking out.
They're on the front lines of fighting for democracy. And that's why it is so important that we get this aid and this assistance to them as quickly as we possibly can. And I know that they are frustrated. I know the president is frustrated, and we're all frustrated. We want to see them get the support that they need so that they can continue to defend themselves and to defend democracy.
As that aid to Ukraine remains stuck in Congress, the Biden administration announced more than 500 sweeping new sanctions on Russia Friday. The announcement comes 2 years after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine and 1 week after the death of imprisoned Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Biden said the new sanctions will ensure Putin pays an even steeper price for his, quote, aggression abroad and repression at home. The new sanctions are far-reaching and target financial and military infrastructure. The list includes sanctions on dozens of Russian banks, investment firms, and venture capital funds. Sanctions also target Russia's future energy production and export, as well as shipbuilding and mining. The sanctions go beyond Russia and target its military allies in Iran, China, and North Korea, and put further penalties on entities that evade sanctions. And a handful of sanctions target those responsible for Navalny's death at a Siberian penal colony. The president met Thursday in California with Navalny's widow and his daughter, who is a university student there. Mr. Biden gave his condolences and expressed his admiration for Navalny's courage and his legacy of fighting against Kremlin corruption. Earlier this week, Yulia Navalnaya vowed to continue her husband's opposition fight against Vladimir Putin, releasing this powerful video just 3 days after his death. Her words in the subtitles.
Убив Алексея, Путин убил половину меня, половину моего сердца и половину моей души. Но у меня осталась вторая половина, и она подсказывает мне, что я не имею права сдаваться, продолжать дело Алексея Навального, продолжать бороться за нашу с вами страну, и я призываю вас встать рядом со мной. Нам нужно использовать каждую возможность бороться против войны, против коррупции, против несправедливости, бороться за честные выборы и свободу слова, бороться за то, чтобы вернуть нашу страну только так и никак иначе. Немыслимая жертва, которую он принес, может стать...
In the meantime, the Navalny family is still trying to retrieve his body. His 69-year-old's mother traveled to a morgue in Siberia near the prison where he was incarcerated to reclaim him, but authorities spent days turning her away and would not confirm his body was there. On Thursday, she was finally permitted to view his remains. She said she was forced to sign the death certificate, which stated Navalny died of natural causes, in order to recover his body.
According to the law, they should have given me Alexei's body right away, but they haven't done it yet. Instead, they blackmailed me and set conditions for where, when, and how Alexei should be buried. It is illegal.
She says authorities separated her from her attorneys, threatened her, and spent hours trying to pressure her to agree to a secret funeral for Navalny that would not attract public mourners. It's believed the Kremlin is worried about thousands of opposition supporters gathering to honor Navalny if the funeral is not private. Earlier in the week, this was the scene in St. Petersburg, Russia, near a monument to Soviet-era political prisoners. Flowers, pictures, and candles in honor of Putin's most prominent opposition leader. And in Moscow, these people risked arrest as they came to pay tribute to Navalny. Police were seen asking residents to move away from an area where flowers were laid. Some were led away by officers. A civil rights group says more than 400 were detained at events across more than 30 Russian cities. Protests against the Russian government were more robust outside the country, particularly in front of Russian embassies. In Germany, hundreds gathered outside the Russian embassy in Berlin to mourn Navalny's death. And in the Russian border country of Georgia, hundreds more gathered outside the Russian embassy in Tbilisi. Many were Russian exiles who had fled Russia at the beginning of the war.
Since the full-scale invasion of Russia to Ukraine, this is one of the most horrible things that has happened to those who are against Putin and represent Russian opposition. And I think that what is going on now is not a real meeting, but it is the attempt to get together and not go crazy.
That woman is among the estimated 1 million Russian nationals, many educated and wealthy, who have left Russia since the outbreak of the war in 2022. Navalny's death and the devastation it creates for many across the globe hoping for political change at the Kremlin comes as the Ukrainian people take a serious look, 2 years in, at the toll of the war with Russia. What began as the shock of invasion and then patriotic fervor to take back their country has now become the grim slog of war. On this second anniversary, EWTN News in Depth went to Ukraine to gauge the mood of the people. Here's correspondent Colin Flynn.
Right across Ukraine, new graveyards are appearing, filled with young men who have died fighting for their country. The pain and sadness, you can feel it as the graveyards get bigger and bigger. The photographs showing just how young some of these boys were. And in the cathedral in Kiev, people line up to have ashes rubbed into their heads. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Something that has become more meaningful now in Ukraine as the war enters its third year. It was here, just an hour outside of Kiev, that the Russian tanks blew their way through trying to make it to the capital. $700 billion worth of damage to this country and an estimated 500,000 troops dead from both armies, not to mention all the civilian casualties. And yet 2 years later, this war in Ukraine still grinds on. And here in Bjorodanka, destruction is everywhere. Sister Victoria Kovlachuk is from Ukraine and working in this town. When you look over here, you can see people's bedrooms, their kitchens.
Yeah, in some bits of furniture, rooms you can still even the furnitures, but the private houses, little small private houses, also destroyed.
It's horrific, isn't it, when you walk out and you just see the marks of war, how brutal it is and senseless.
Yeah, and I would never imagine it can happen nowadays.
It's hard to believe that just 2 years ago, these were people's homes, where families and children lived.
Some are still missing, and the people here from Borodenko, they don't know if they're alive, somewhere escaped, or maybe were buried under these walls.
The people who survived in this town now live in prefabricated homes. And every week, Sister Victoria visits to spend time with the children. She gets them to paint symbols of hope, of happiness, and of peace. She's trying to make life a little more joyous and normal for the children, many of whom, in their young age, have seen things that most of us will thankfully never see in our lifetime. What are you painting?
I'm drawing a butterfly.
Do you like painting?
Yes, because it calms me down.
When asked what they'd like to paint, many of the children say their home.
We are painting, like here you can see houses. Yeah. Children are dreaming of going back to their houses or to living in their flats, in the peaceful cities. The sky should be filled with the birds and balloons, not with the missiles or drones.
Sister Victoria's presence is also a great support for their mothers, as most of their fathers are fighting in the war, or worse.
We do our best to make sure the children have everything they need. Sister Victoria has been such a great support for us, because not only is she helping the children, but she's helping us mothers too when we have difficult moments.
And the flag that the children are painting on will be sent to the front line.
This flag, when you're finished, where will this flag go?
I'm drawing for the soldiers.
Why is that important?
I want them to know that they're remembered and not forgotten.
The war in Ukraine has had a heavy toll on children. According to UNICEF, 4.1 million are in need of humanitarian aid. Children here face mental health issues, emotional stress, and deep sadness. And tragically, it's been reported that more than 1,500 children
have died so far.
We are now in the section where the very small children live, the ones that are under a year old. The youngest here is only 24 days old, and the oldest is 5 months.
Close to Bjordanka, in the town of Vorsel, there is an orphanage. Some of these children, their parents were killed. Other mothers gave them up at birth because of not having a home and the emotional and psychological trauma of this war. Tatiana Limar is the orphanage director.
Of course, it's all connected with the war, because the families who have had these children, they lost everything they had in the war, including their homes. So they felt like they just couldn't look after them. But you know, I really love when our children, our chicks, fly out of our nest, when a loving mother and father come and adopt them. This is why we work here.
These children are awaiting adoption. But we're told some have suffered deep trauma and will need psychological help. The Catholic institution, the Order of Malta, has been helping to fund places like this, offering play equipment, aid, and paying for psychologists for the children.
Well, I can tell how much the war has affected society, which I see through the children that enter our orphanage. The war has impoverished the population, increased the anxiety of the population. The people's psyche has been broken. Some mothers are so broken, they are struggling themselves, not to mention trying to look after the well-being of a child. And so tragically, they are forced to leave their child in the hope that it will have a happier future, even if that means it will be with another family.
For the director Tatiana, caring for these children has become her life's mission after her husband was killed in this war.
My life today is divided in two parts, before the war started and after the war started. Before the war, I had a large family. I had a wonderful husband, and we were together for 30 years. I lost my husband. My grandchildren are in another country. Now, all I have is my job. And actually, this is what keeps me going.
The death toll of this war is staggering. There are no official numbers of those who have died, but the U.S. government estimates it to be around 500,000 troops from both armies. And for the ones who do return from the front line, many are badly injured. Outside the city of Lviv in the west of Ukraine is the Heri Chania Rehabilitation Center. This is another center which is supported by the Order of Malta, where inside the corridors, the young men are missing arms and legs, and each has a story to tell. Like Ivan Markovetsky, who was a school teacher before being trained for 2 months and sent to fight.
I was on the front line for 11 months, and before that, I had only read about these things in books. War for me was only in books.
What happened? Tell me about that moment that led to you being here in the hospital.
A landmine landed right next to my leg and exploded. I received numerous shrapnel injuries. My eardrums blew out, and I received a head injury. And immediately, I knew that I had lost a leg. As soon as I regained consciousness, I crawled out of the trench and tried to stand up, but I lost my balance and fell. I saw right then that I had lost my leg, but I accepted it straight away, because if I survived a direct hit, then God still had plans for me. And since that very moment, I've not given up.
Since this war began, the Catholic Church has been supporting the people. From the very top, Pope Francis immediately calling for peace, to the ground level right here in Ukraine.
And you can see the hole in the wall where the missiles struck through.
Yes.
Today,
yes.
Father Paul Vyshkovsky is visiting a neighborhood in his parish here in Kiev that just a few days ago was struck by a Russian missile. It tore a hole in this apartment block, killing 5 people. He regularly checks in to see how the people are coping.
As soon as my children went to sleep, we heard explosions ring out, one not so strong, and then another really, really powerful one. We jumped out into the corridor and heard glass shatter. Some of the upper floors, our neighbors' windows were all blown in.
Were you very scared?
Yes, of course. I have children.
This woman is like so many internally displaced people who moved here to Kiev from the Donetsk region, thinking it would be safer. Much of her family is still back home.
Well, my family is still back in Donetsk, and it's very scary. There are scares all the time, and I won't even tell you about the number who are dead and wounded.
Let's pray and hope that peace and victory will come.
I would like to, because everyone has been waiting for our victory for a long time.
How do people cope at a time like this, Father? How do they keep on going?
We hope, we wait that this war will be not so long, because for us it's very hard.
It's too much.
It's too much. Every day we pray for conversion of our enemies, every day.
As Father Paul and I continue to walk outside, out of the corner of my eye, I spot something in the distance.
Pardon?
I just noticed it's a crucifix, Jesus.
Crucifix.
Down there on the wall. The small thing, you see? Oh, wow.
Oh.
We walk over, and to our amazement, what we found was a crucifix from one of the bombed apartments.
Someone lived this.
The cross was damaged, but Jesus in the center was mainly intact.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's amazing that you saw it.
Wow. What does this say to you, Father, when you see something like this?
God is very close to us. He is present among people, among us. We feel very strong presence of God.
In St. Nicholas's Church in the center of Kiev, Father Alexander Zelensky places ashes on the heads of the faithful for Ash Wednesday, a reminder, not that the people here need it, that life is fleeting and for everyone will one day end. So to stay focused on the next life. Father Alexander runs EWTN Ukraine.
How have things changed? Because at the beginning we know that everybody was so enthusiastic about victory and sure about victory, a quick victory. Now 2 years have passed and the war is slowly grinding on with more and more people dying. It's hard to find hope sometimes. So when you're talking to people about their faith, how do you find it's been affected after the 2 years?
Yeah, we can see from one side, we can see that people try to have their ordinary life, but from the other side is this what we can't see. It's like what is inside people. So this is like some
heaviness. There's a heaviness there.
Yeah, some heaviness which is in the heart of people. God is with us, and He will help us to rebuild, to renew what is destroyed.
As you've seen, it's the ordinary people who are suffering the most in this war. And as we pass the 2 year mark, the eyes of the world are beginning to shift from Ukraine. But for the people who live here, the misery continues. And now the question is, how much longer of the fighting, of the shelling, of the bombing, and of the dying? In Ukraine, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
Safely back home from his trip to Ukraine, Colm joins us now from Rome. Colm, what a powerful report. And since the war began, you have been to Ukraine 3 times to report for EWTN News, this time on this second anniversary. Tell us about the change in the mood that you've seen since your earlier trips.
Hi, Catherine. Great to talk to you. And you're right, the mood is much different. When I first went there, there was definitely an atmosphere that the people were expecting a quick and a definite victory over Russia, and particularly with the international community really rallying behind them, government officials and world leaders even coming to Kiev. So between then and now, the atmosphere has certainly changed, because remember, you saw in that video clip there the flags flying in those graveyards that are popping up all over Ukraine. Young people in particular are seeing this and they're sharing it on social media. And then you have rumours of the numbers, the amount of men that they have lost so far in this after 2 years. So I would say, to summarise, at the beginning there was an atmosphere of fear, yes, but of this enthusiasm to fight and to have victory. And now you have this atmosphere of exhaustion, really, and that now mixed with sorrow.
For those of us who have not been on the ground in Ukraine, what's been your biggest takeaway?
My takeaway, and this might sound silly, Catherine, but it is just how real it is, because thank God for most of us, we live in peaceful times. We can't even imagine what it's like to live in a war or a situation like this. And you see it on television and you see it on your iPhone, but to be there and experience it in just a little way. For example, one of the nights when we were filming in Kiev, that report, myself and the crew, we were woken up at 4:47 a.m. in the middle of the night by the air raid going off. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden you have this big announcement in the hotel telling guests to take shelter and go down to the car park, the bomb shelter. I open the window and you hear the air raid siren sounding over Kiev, a very eerie sound that you just know from movies. So that's one thing. And the next day to feel exhausted and anxious and frightened, then to imagine how they must feel hearing that all the time, every day. And the other thing, Catherine, that made it very real was talking to the young people our own age who are facing conscription and who really do not want to go. Again, at the start, there was a great enthusiasm. Those who wanted to fight went to the front line. But now, as more young people again are seeing the graves and they're seeing those who are making it back, as you saw in that report, missing limbs, badly injured, there's a huge reluctance now from young people to go to the front line.
Colm, I have just a moment with you. Where are you seeing any glimmer of hope among the Ukrainian people today?
You know, Catherine, it is very difficult to talk to people about faith in God at a time of war, particularly when they've lost everything. But what I found talking to soldiers who've come back from the front line, talking to the people who've lost their homes, that for many Ukrainians, this war is actually reaffirming their faith and their belief in God and not the opposite. So that was an incredible thing to see.
Mm. Colm Flynn, thank you so much and glad you're back safe.
Thanks, Catherine.
Colm traveled to Ukraine with the Catholic lay organization, the Order of Malta, which focuses on international humanitarian assistance. You can watch his interview with its ambassador to Ukraine, Antonio Gazzanti, on the work they've been doing in Ukraine on the EWTN YouTube channel. As we continue to watch the war developments between Israel and Hamas, the United States is facing criticism for vetoing a United Nations Gaza ceasefire resolution on Tuesday. The U.S. claims it would interfere with negotiations to free hostages abducted in Israel on October 7th, when Hamas militants invaded southern Israel, killing 1,200 and abducting 250 others. Since then, more than 29,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's offensive. There is much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. A court rules frozen embryos deserve legal protections. Reaction to the major decision out of Alabama. German bishops on the verge of more church controversy take a different path. Analysis coming up. And this.
It's called New York Encounter. It's centered in Christ, and it keeps gaining more and more attention. And it's focused at the crossroads of faith and culture.
Next, reporter Mark Irons takes us to a unique gathering in New York City, designed to show the human beauty in the world that springs from God. How this event is bringing together both the faithful and those who are seeking answers.
If I had a flag that all running all across Charlotte that said, "Eat my flesh," and on the other side said, "Drink my blood," and like red.
And that is exactly what this athlete carried with him. His unique way of spreading Christ's invitation for healing and renewal in the Eucharist.
Music and comedy are arts and love. All of that has to do with God. Anything good and beautiful is from God.
In the city that never sleeps, an annual event called New York Encounter is helping Catholics and those who are non-religious wake up to the reality of God through education, dialogue, music, and more. Mark Irons attended the encounter and brings us more in this Catholic Life report.
What does the world look like when you pay attention to it more closely?
You could miss a lot unless you take the time to encounter what's happening around you. In the largest city in America, off a busy street in a nondescript building, it seems like people are just being people.
I love eating, I love drinking, I love good wine.
You know, people are talking about political issues, but also artistic issues.
They're spending time together, reflecting on those things that bring us together and those that tear us apart.
A brutal massacre in Israel and then a brutal war in Gaza.
This is the biggest annual gathering yet. Thousands have come from around the country to participate.
It's called New York Encounter. It's inspired by Christ, and it keeps gaining more and more attention.
There's no entry fee. All are welcome inside, and you'll encounter a little bit of everything in the fellowship, talks, and exhibits. Music, literature, technology, politics, art, science, and discussions around the joys and sufferings of life. But many of the attendees seem to share a common thought about all these different things.
I think an implicit trust that an encounter with God can always be found there.
Father Patty Gilger is a professor of sociology at Loyola University Chicago. Within his doctoral research, he took a closer look at the lay Catholic movement that organizes this annual New York Encounter. It's called Communion and Liberation.
Communion and Liberation is characterized by the trust that God can always be encountered in reality if we are attentive.
And for many lay Catholics of Communion and Liberation, there's an understanding of this reality. Not everyone is Catholic, but we all are human, and that's a good place to start.
What do I want? And what is my heart telling me that I want out of life? And from there, eventually, you reach the point of Christ. But you can't start from Christ without understanding yourself.
So if you look around this three-day event, you will find those more explicit signs of Catholicism, priests, religious sisters, spiritual reading, and religious art. But the atmosphere created encourages a faith that isn't foreign to or isolated from the rest of the wider culture.
A real openness to the world. So hopefully, people who do not belong to the church can come and feel very welcome and participative and interested in what might be presented.
I've felt welcome since day one by everybody.
Sam Valle came here with his girlfriend, Mayella, who is a practicing Catholic and member of Communion and Liberation. As for Sam, he was raised Catholic but hasn't practiced in about 20 years. Growing up, one of the things that turned him away from faith was the feeling that it was forced upon him. This encounter has shown him something else.
Seeing a different side of it, where it's not just, you know, let's go to church, let's pray a rosary, let's pray for 2 hours, or, you know, whatever it may be. It keeps it interesting.
In the 1950s, Communion and Liberation was founded in Italy by Father Luigi Giussani. In the Catholic Church today, he's known as a servant of God, meaning he could one day be recognized as a saint. One quote that helps encapsulate his teaching, he said, "When you are clearly conscious of the supreme truth that is the face of Christ, then you see something good in all you meet." It's a concept a longtime attendee to New York Encounter, Natalie Pulzer from Texas, takes to heart.
So it's this really understanding of seeking and, you know, asking, where are you, Lord, in the particular circumstances and the people in my life. Father Giussani has really educated us, you know, and me in this charism, that's the invitation of Christianity.
To encounter Christ in everything, including areas of pain. Dr. Dulce Cruz spoke on a panel exploring the value of suffering. Sharing her personal experience as a geriatrician and palliative care doctor, she hopes people will pay more attention to euthanasia and assisted suicide and start to have conversations around it.
More than talking about are you in favor or against, talk about life. Why is life worth living? Why is it worth going through struggles? Why is it worth going through illness?
Father Ryan Mann, a priest from Cleveland, Ohio, also spoke on a panel describing how our human experiences have value.
The whole idea is anything that's authentically human has an echo in the gospel.
He says God doesn't want to take away interest or desires, but fulfill them.
Whether it's science or film or politics or money or sexuality, anything authentically human has an echo in the gospel, meaning the gospel purifies it and fulfills it, showing us what is really good and true, and then shows us the way to live it in such a way that actually leads us to fulfillment.
And I still feel-
On Saturday night, the sounds of a singer-songwriter contest filled this auditorium. And the next morning, the same people celebrating a night of soulful music were worshiping together. Presiding at Sunday Mass, Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York, alongside the Pope's ambassador to the U.S., Cardinal Christophe Pierre. And we caught up with Cardinal Sean O'Malley of Boston, who said this event helps form disciples of Christ.
Discipleship is learned like a language by being part of a community that speaks that language. And here people are learning to speak that language of faith, that language of love.
He wants to say something, maybe. He's waving to the camera.
And it's a language that parents are also passing on to their children. At New York Encounter, an effort was made to welcome young families like Andrew and Natasha Crema and their newly baptized son, Andres.
Wherever we go, he goes.
I think that he'll find something beautiful in it, hopefully the fact that Christ is the center of our lives and that one day he also will make Christ the center of his life.
When the founder of Communion and Liberation, Father Luigi Giussani, passed away in 2005, then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger presided over the funeral mass. He said Giussani kept his heart fixed on Christ, and it was in this way that he understood that Christianity is not an intellectual system, a collection of dogmas, or moralism. Christianity is instead an encounter, a love story. It is an event. Participants at this New York Encounter say that understanding of Christianity becomes clear.
What you see more. I mean, the goal, in a sense, like, because we know Christ, because we know God, like, we should be able to see the whole of reality.
But if you aren't paying attention, you might miss it. Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
Headlines are next in the Week in Review.
I think it's very, very important to realize that the in vitro fertilization, the IVF industry, really treats children in a way that is completely undignified.
A court ruling in Alabama could eventually mean changes across the country for couples trying to conceive through in vitro fertilization. That and much more when we come back. A major ruling from the Alabama State Supreme Court tops our Week in Review. The state's high court has ruled that frozen human embryos created through in vitro fertilization are considered children under the law. The court ruled in response to a wrongful death lawsuit brought by several parents whose frozen embryos were accidentally destroyed at a fertility clinic. In an 8-1 decision, the high court said state law applies to, quote, all children born and unborn without limitation. The ruling has received nationwide attention. At the time we record this program, three fertility clinics in the state have already paused all IVF treatments. Proponents of IVF harshly criticized the ruling.
Equating an embryo to a child is scientifically unfounded, and the clinical ramifications of such a legal decision are tremendous and will undoubtedly have unintended consequences, including limiting the capacity of physicians to care for patients with infertility, many of whom are reliant on IVF to be able to build their families.
Joseph Meany, president of the National Catholic Bioethics Center, disagrees and says the ruling clearly reflects the reality of unborn life.
We become new human beings at the moment of conception. And the church is very clear about this. Science is very clear about this. And it's very nice to see that legislative bodies and courts are recognizing this as well. It's important to realize that if we're going to be pro-life, we have to be consistent. We have to realize that if life begins at conception, then all those conceived human beings should be protected, whether they're in an IVF lab or in the womb of their mothers. These are new human beings that deserve protection.
While the Catholic Church is not against the use of technology and medicine to help overcome infertility, it teaches IVF is never acceptable, as it often leads to embryos being destroyed, used for experimentation, or frozen indefinitely. IVF also removes the conception of a child from the marital act. Bishop Stephen Reka of the Diocese of Birmingham celebrated the ruling from his state and believes it's a crucial step in protecting the dignity of life from the moment of conception.
Really sort of puts into focus the fact that all life should be treated with a certain respect of the dignity that it is accorded to by God. Our prayers that we often say in church, that life should be respected from the moment of conception to natural death, comes into play here as we examine this question, you know, that the court had ruled on, very much in concord with our hopes and prayers.
Pro-life advocates are hopeful that Alabama's ruling could lead other states to enact similar protections for the unborn. Just days after this ruling, the state Supreme Court received a request from Alabama to find a date to execute another death row inmate with nitrogen gas. The state Supreme Court initially agreed in 2022 to a nitrogen execution for Alan Miller, who has been on death row since 2000 for killing three people in 1999. This request comes just a month after the state executed Kenneth Smith using the new and highly controversial method. Alabama has said nitrogen gas is the most painless and humane form of execution, though many human rights groups have called it cruel and torturous. In 2018, Pope Francis revised the Catholic Catechism's teaching on the death penalty to state it is inadmissible. Following pressure from the Vatican, the German bishops have halted their efforts to establish what they call a synodal council. The bishops, shown here at a previous meeting in Rome, initially planned to vote this week on a committee that's preparing the synodal council. But they canceled the vote after the Vatican sent them a letter requesting as much. The synodal council would have been a governing body of the German church. The bishops hoped it would serve as a permanent continuation of the controversial German Synodal Way, which was pushing for a path for the blessing of same-sex unions, a female diaconate, and changes in the way the church is governed. The Vatican has been vocal about its discouragement of such a council and has made numerous efforts in recent years to intervene. To help explain these latest developments, we are joined in studio by our colleague AC Wimmer, editor-in-chief of CNA Deutsch. AC, thanks for joining us. What can you tell us about the Vatican's letter? Explain why Rome is opposed to the creation of this synodal council.
Thanks, Catherine. Look, the situation is really complicated on one hand, but on the other hand, it's really simple. The Vatican's reminded the German bishops and those pushing for those reforms that the way they're going about it is arguably not in line with the sacramental structure of the church, with the way the church, the Roman Catholic Church, is set up, not the German Catholic Church. And that is something they're grappling with now, arguably with a way of a pause, perhaps a sign of compliance.
How have the German bishops been reacting to this letter?
So on the one hand, there's been some debate about it publicly, but most of the stuff that you're not hearing, the stuff that's happening behind closed doors, from the sources that we have, is telling us that they're extremely concerned because, on the one hand, they're juggling, of course, these concerns and the renewed interventions from the Vatican. But on the other hand, they're juggling what could arguably be the ghosts that they've unleashed themselves, the calls for what they think are reforms or what is debated as a reform, and all the political demands that are connected to that. So that's a pretty heady mix.
The Vatican has not shied away from criticizing this synodal way, but this is the first time it seems the German bishops actually heeded its warning. Why is that?
I think there's a clearly visible red line here that they don't want to cross. There really is threat of a schism. And you can also tell that that's what's looming by the way things are being publicly debated, even by cardinals considered not very conservative necessarily, such as Cardinal Christoph Schönborn of Vienna, such as Cardinal Walter Kasper, who's a close theological advisor of Pope Francis, have come out with cautious words, cautioning words for the German bishops.
AC, is this plan for a synodal council in Germany completely off the table or just on hold? Do we know what is next for the German synodal way?
We know that it is on hold. I don't think it's off the agenda, according to most of the people that we've spoken to, for good reason, because we know also that these statutes have been approved by the other side, if you like, of the German Synodal Way, which is the Central Committee of German Catholics. And it's ongoing in terms of the debate how what can be achieved perhaps through other means. So you might not have a synodal committee setting up a synodal council to perpetuate a synodal way, but you will have to find a way, even if it's just a dovetail with, after all, what is the Church's Synod on Synodality, which is due to kick off again in October in Rome.
Well, on that very point, putting this all into context, how does what's happening in Germany fit into the Church's global Synod on Synodality?
Spot on. That is indeed the question. And in fact, if I may, Catherine, one of the things that could pop out here is a really interesting result, namely that some of the things that have been put on the agenda by a process that is now thrown into question may be thrown into question for the bigger process. Mm-hmm. And if that is what observers are concerned about, in particular also reform-minded cardinals, then we're in for a very interesting season here, not only in Germany, but also in the Vatican and the wider, the universal church.
Finally, AC, I want to get your take on this. What does Germany's synodal path reveal about the concept of synodality in general?
So that's a really interesting question as well, and it's a wider one that needs debating, not just for the synod on synodality, which after all the Holy Father has called for, but also that process in the beginning launched in 2019 and immediately, you know, criticized by Pope Francis in a letter that he wrote to the German Catholics. Can you have a process sui generis, sort of its own bat, if it's not a synod? The German synodal way is not a synod, and if it's not a plenary council such as we've had in other countries, well, the jury may still be out, but it looks like we're getting a verdict pretty soon.
Well, AC Vimmer, thank you so much for your insight.
Thank you.
The Vatican announced dates for the second and final assembly of the Synod on Synodality this year. This meeting will end the three-year period of listening and discernment set into motion by Pope Francis. Synod delegates, which include bishops and lay people, will begin their meetings on October 2nd and conclude on the 27th. This week marks 2 months since media mogul Jimmy Lai's trial began. He has been imprisoned for years on various charges stemming from his support for democracy and free speech in Hong Kong. The 76-year-old faces two charges, including collusion with foreign forces under the draconian national security law that the Communist Party implemented in Hong Kong in 2020. He has pleaded not guilty. This week, one of his former colleagues testified against him in court, saying Lai used his newspaper to garner support from the international community for pro-democracy efforts. Bill McGurn, opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, is Lai's godfather and receives letters from Lai in prison. He told EWTN News Nightly's Tracy Sable that Lai's Catholic faith, as well as prayers from faithful around the world, bring him peace.
A lot of people come up to me and say, hey, you know, my husband and I are praying for Jimmy Lai every day. His family is very humbled by that. And I think Jimmy feels those prayers. He's in solitary, so it's a tough haul for him. But there's a lot of support for him on the outside. Legions that he doesn't know.
The trial is likely to go on for months. If found guilty, Lai could face life in prison. The Catholic University of America installed one of Lai's drawings on campus this week. The vibrant artwork, sketched on a piece of notebook paper with colored pencils, depicts Christ suffering on the cross. Lai created the work in 2022 from his prison cell in Hong Kong. We'll be right back.
Because for Catholics, like, we need to get a kick in the butt and realize, like, what we're receiving in Mass every time we're in Mass.
Next, what one Catholic runner is doing to encourage others to appreciate the beauty of the Eucharist, one step at a time. New information this week about the upcoming National Eucharistic Congress this summer in Indianapolis. The celebration is designed to restore understanding and devotion to the Eucharist and is an invitation to experience a personal revival in faith. The Congress will take place over several days from July 17th to the 21st at Lucas Oil Stadium and Indiana Convention Center, featuring exhibits, talks, masses, adoration, and more. Leading up to the Congress will be pilgrimages from four corners of the U.S. A newly released map shows additional details about the four pilgrimage routes. After kickoff celebrations in mid-May, pilgrims will make their way from the north, east, west, and south to the Congress in July. Each diocese along the way will host masses, adoration, and processions at shrines, cathedrals, and holy sites. If you are interested in attending the National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis, you can sign up through EWTN. Go to EWTN.com/Eucharist and click on Register Now and receive a discount. In conjunction with the National Eucharistic Revival, a Catholic athlete is going above and beyond to draw attention to his reverence for the Eucharist. The North Carolina runner is waving the flag to attract others to understanding and devotion of the real presence. Reporter Rissell Regis has this faith journey in depth.
You just sit there and you're in the presence of God. Then how awesome is that?
Spending time adoring the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist has always been special for husband, father, and entrepreneur Jimmy Coleman. This was one of the reasons why he created Adoration Ultra.
A lot of people already experience that, those conversations with God on their runs, and so maybe there's a simple way of doing it, just like adoration, and maybe there's a way of like making it even more meaningful as well.
He recently completed a 50.6-mile run, stopping at five parishes in the Charlotte, North Carolina area, and spending time in Eucharistic adoration at each one. He began with Mass and Eucharistic adoration at his home parish of St. Mark Church in Huntersville.
I shared it with our church and just let them know, hey, this is the thing I'm doing. If this provides value to the church in some way, like, feel free to, you know, do something with it.
That's when Coleman's Adoration Ultra started sparking interest in the community. He was featured in his local diocesan newspaper, the Catholic News Herald, and even the Catholic News Agency, detailing his intentions. So when it came time for his run, he received more support than he thought he would. A couple of friends even joined him for parts of the run. And if nationwide attention wasn't enough, during the run, he wanted everyone to know who he was running for, our Lord Jesus Christ.
I thought it'd be a missed opportunity to be running past all these people and for them to not know what this guy running past him is doing or just not even notice. And so I was thinking, what if I had this huge flag? And what if on that flag, there was something that was like a call to action?
That call to action, eat my flesh and drink my blood on either side.
Yeah, one guy pulled over in his car and he was just fired up that he's seeing someone that's just as jacked up about Jesus as he is. Some people just give me fist bumps because they could tell that it was about Jesus along the way, and then a lot of honks.
Powered by prayer, throughout his run, he felt even closer to the Lord.
As the day goes on, I'm like getting weaker and weaker and weaker, and like just being more humbled in his presence in that way. And that was a beautiful thing.
Coleman's first Adoration Ultra coincides with the ongoing National Eucharistic Revival, the U.S. Bishop's three-year movement to restore understanding and devotion to the Eucharist. Coleman hopes his recent run inspires other Catholics and those who may be questioning their faith, which is something he experienced at a point in his life. He grew up in a Catholic household, but during college, he fell away from the Catholic faith and started attending Protestant churches with his friends.
But I started looking deeper into the theology of these churches, and around the time that my son was expected to be born, because I didn't just want to pass on to them what was just convenient for me.
Coleman then started his spiritual journey.
Where would I be as a spiritual leader of the household? When my children ask all the why questions, how good of a job will I do at answering those questions?
After a lot of soul searching and digging deeper into the church's teaching, it was the Eucharist that brought him back to Catholicism.
There it is.
Now with two children and another on the way, he is even more motivated to take his dreams to another level.
How cool would it be if I were to re-pursue this dream of being a pro athlete while also being a business owner, while also being devout in my faith?
With his family fully supporting him, Coleman said he hopes to continue Adoration Ultra and ultimately build a community of Catholic runners nationwide who adore Christ.
Very Jimmy to come up with something kind of off the handle on his own and to have it be faith-based. And I thought it was great. It was a great thing for the boys to be able to remember growing up, and just very unique and very, very him. I hope it blows up in the most positive way possible, and it can just be an example to everyone else.
With Sal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
When we return, some final thoughts as we mark the second anniversary of the war in Ukraine. Earlier in this program, we took you to Ukraine to show you what the people are experiencing there as the horror of war with Russia heads into its third year. Our hearts were hurt at the sight of that sea of graves, young soldiers who gave their lives in battle. As we close our program today, we go back to Kyiv for a powerful reminder of the toll of war. May these soldiers rest in the embrace of God's loving arms.